I'm Emily Jashinsky.
I'm Josh Hammer.
I'm Rachel Bovard.
And I'm Ben Weingarten.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's show is kind of a special edition because we are taping the day after Justice Clarence Thomas issued an opinion that is rich with avenues for conversation from the perspective and with the framing that we come to you with every week about common good and common sense. So to start this conversation off, I'm going to kick it right away to Rachel, who's having a great day basking in the warmth of Clarence Thomas's writing.
Yes, thank you. You know, so many of us have been working on these big tech issues, I think, have been subject to some intense gaslighting, you know, by people who say the issues you raise aren't relevant, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And so I think to see this opinion or concurrence issued from Clarence Thomas yesterday was just such a delight. And I think we've been reveling in it since then. But to get to the subject matter of the piece itself, you know, Clarence Thomas took an opportunity to sort of point out the ridiculous sort of posture these platforms receive in our society, because he was responding to a decision or a case that came out of the Second Circuit, which basically said, look, you know, Trump can't actually block people on his Twitter. That was the subject of that case, because his Twitter is a public forum. It is he's a government official, it's a public forum, so everybody needs to have access to it. But yet our public policy treats these platforms like they're private platforms and lets them do whatever they want, going so far as Twitter did to block the president of the United States. So on one hand, it's a public forum, a government space, Trump can't block people. But on the other, the Twitter can just be a private actor and kick off whomever they want, including the president. So diving into that disparity, Clarence Thomas, you know, writes this big concurrence that I think really touches on a number of broad themes that are animating much of the public policy discussion about big tech. And I think the beauty of this concurrence itself is that it sees the world as it is. And it sees the world for the threats that big tech is perpetuating, the sort of dichotomy between how we treat other sort of big, you know, speech moderators and platforms in our society. And it gets to the heart, I think, of what a lot of us are concerned about. So a couple of things I'll just talk about briefly, and then, you know, I think we can open it up for general critique or applause, you know, it could go either way. But the first thing that he does, I think, is actually legitimize the threat of concentrated corporate power. And this is something we've talked about before on this show. And I think something that, you know, is animating a lot of people on the right now, which is for 30 years, the Republican Party, and I think generally our politics in particular, has gone after or treated corporations as, you know, private entities that are free to do whatever they want, and that's the market at work. And that, I think, bears out in most cases, but when you get corporations of this size that are able to wield power in such a dramatic fashion over speech, information flow, public discourse, the things that really animate democracy, right, the things that allow us to transact in a free society with ideas, not to mention the market itself, that is a problem. And Clarence Thomas really hit on that and said, you know, in every other area where you have companies that, you know, have this type of control over the flow of information and discourse, you have something called a common carrier regulation, which prohibits those companies from acting in discriminatory ways. It doesn't make those companies liable for the information that they, you know, send, right? Western Union isn't liable for what is transacted across its platform unless they knowingly transmit criminal material, but they cannot discriminate over who uses their platform and what it is used for, again, absent it being knowingly criminal. And he's pointing out why we don't treat, you know, these big tech companies in the same way. So he makes, I think, a significant case for laws potentially going forward that may, in fact, you know, treat these companies as common carriers. And he also sort of references the massive liability shield that these companies have generated in the form of Section 230, which I know Ben's going to talk about in a little bit, but he's touching on two key public policy debates as it relates to big tech, the common carrier regulation and Section 230. But one of the things I also loved that he did was he just made kind of a mockery of this green eye shade argument that we hear constantly as it relates to, is there a competitive marketplace in big tech? you know, because there's not, right? But every sort of, there's a group of people in DC on the right, traditional sort of libertarian style thinking that says, well, the existence of Bing proves that Google is not a monopoly, proves that there is alternative competition. And again, it's a literal reading of what in practice is not at all sort of how it's manifesting. And I wanted to read that part of the opinion because I loved it so much, when he basically says, it changes nothing that these platforms are not the sole means for distributing speech or information. A person always could choose to avoid the toll bridge or train and instead swim the Charles River or hike the Oregon Trail. And then he goes on, but assessing whether a company exercises substantial market power, what matters is whether the alternatives are comparable. And in many of today's digital platforms, nothing is. And he ends the quote there. I just think that obliterates so many of the arguments that we've heard for so long that says, well, you know, Bing exists, you know, Parler existed, you know, therefore there's this competitive marketplace. And it's like, no, you have to look at the market as it is. And our antitrust laws that he doesn't really get into here, but our antitrust laws are concerned mostly with the durability, right, of a monopoly, right? When there's no competition for so long and no meaningful competition, that is of concern. So, you know, I really think it was a hugely significant piece from Justice Thomas that I suspect, and I'll let sort of the lawyers pontificate on that issue, but I suspect will invite challenges and will invite cases that, you know, will allow the Supreme Court or give the Supreme Court the opportunity to opine, you know, on the type of laws and legal status that these companies have had and if they are abusing it. So what's been interesting, the last thing I'll say, it's been interesting to watch the critiques from both the left and parts of the right that are, you know, besmirching Justice Thomas himself, but also, you know, his opinion saying he wants to mandate speech. And I think it really is concerning to me a little bit that they are going in so hard for the First Amendment rights of these corporations, you know, to the extent that these corporations have become undemocratic. They've become a threat to, again, our self-government and how we make decisions in America. They would prefer to err on the side of that as opposed to a side of, you know, again, corporations acting freely in America, but subject to the laws in which we ourselves decide. The corporations don't rule here, we do. And that's, I think, essentially what's at the heart of so much of the discussion around big tech. So with that, I'll open it up for others to weigh in.
Yeah, look, I think yesterday was just a great day for those of us and kind of the tech skeptical crowd. I think it's important to kind of contextualize basically what happened here. Section 230 was not really anywhere close to a household item in the discourse and the policy discussion on Capitol Hill, any of that. From my perspective, until at least 2 or 3 years ago, right? Senator Josh Hawley kind of was a freshman senator in January 2019. He helped kind of bring this issue to the forefront. It kind of came out of nowhere. And I think it kind of shook up a lot of people, right? It's kind of, it's very difficult to kind of disentangle the tech issue, I think, from this broader kind of realignment, kind of rethinking of kind of our old kind of free market fundamentals orthodoxies. And it really kind of shook up the kind of libertarian leaning, I think, conservative establishment in many ways. And like people like Rachel, people like me who have been oftentimes kind of the front lines of this, I think have gotten like the real heat from people who are basically saying like, who are you, heretic? Like, stop saying this. Like, corporations are good, period. The conversation basically stops there. And I think it's important to note that, you know, a lot of these public policies, a lot of these kind of legal novel arguments that have been floated over the past 2 years were basically just bestowed the imprimatur of legitimacy by the most important conservative lawyer in America, that being Justice Thomas, obviously. So really just a fantastic day. Justice Thomas is kind of the tip of the spear from my perspective of the conservative legal movement. I mean, as a Federal Society member, Federal Society speaker, people truly kind of idolize him for good reasons, to be clear. I'm not downplaying that. He is the greatest living American from my perspective. I've been saying that for 10 years now, probably. So look, as far as what he's actually talking about here, kind of getting into the weeds a little bit more, we're going to get into the 230 discussion. I personally feel a little vindicated on the common carrier stuff. I've been saying for 6-7 months now, especially going back to the Hunter Biden New York Post fiasco, I had a post for the American Compass website basically saying what to do after big tech's quote Pearl Harbor attack on the New York Post. And I basically said, like, two-thirds antitrust, these are important issues, to be sure. I am not downplaying them. But we should probably be thinking, like, even broader here. We should start talking about common carrier regulation. We should start talking about public accommodation status under the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I'm not the only one who's done that. Michael Lind, there are many other people who have kind of made these similar arguments. But, you know, even in these current, like, tech-related Federal Society events that I currently do, like, when I just last week, actually, I dropped the word common carrier, you know, in a debate with Jennifer Huddleston of the American Action Forum. And, like, that term kind of drops like a lead balloon sometimes in some circles when you kind of get it out there. So I just cannot emphasize enough how important it is, how much of a paradigm shift it is to have the most important conservative legal thinker in America forthrightly, unapologetically making these arguments. So it is a huge victory for those of us in kind of the tech skeptical crowd, those of us on the conservative right that want to actually use power before it is too late to rein in these tech companies. Very tough day, obviously, for the build your own Google smart set. So the battle lines, I think, are continuing to harden. It's just, I'd be curious, you know, what Ben and Emily think of this. I don't really know what the immediate future holds for tech apologists, especially on the right. I mean, when Justice Thomas is out there kind of making these arguments, it's not entirely obvious to me how kind of the, you know, tech freedom kind of Koch brothers world recovers from that.
Yeah, I must confess, and I have an article probably from a few years ago talking about the fact that kind of government regulation isn't the way to go to combat big tech. And I always have held to my sort of free market leanings, but we have to be clear about something, which is that the big tech companies have not prospered to such an extent due to free market. They've actually done so as a consequence of legislation that we'll speak to in part shortly, including Section 230. So one of the things that Justice Thomas says is that market power matters in determining what, if anything, the government role is, and including the Supreme Court's role is in adjudicating on matters like these. But so too do the privileges conferred on people that were able to accrue that power, and those privileges help them accrue that power. So, you know, beyond what's plain as day for all to see, that there are a few dominant players in a marketplace, and they are using their power illiberally, and government is leaning on them to use their power illiberally. And going back to the start of this, it pays to point out that this is not simply free market actors acting as they so choose. And of course, as we'll speak to when it comes to Section 230 and the way it's been interpreted, it's basically given them a privilege so far beyond the text that it renders the text of Section 230 essentially meaningless, I would argue. And Justice Thomas argued in a predecessor case to this one, addressing something else relating to Section 230. But more broadly, I think the significance of his opinion here is he's basically saying there are both legislative and lawfare-based remedies for people to challenge Section 230. And he's raising some of the ways that it can be done in this very short opinion that everyone ought to read. And I think the way he frames the issue is important. And so I'll just close my brief remarks with how he closes that opinion. And he says, I quote, "The Second Circuit feared that then President Trump cut off speech by using the features that Twitter made available to him. But if the aim is to ensure that speech is not smothered, then the more glaring concern must perforce be the dominant digital platforms themselves. As Twitter made clear, the right to cut off speech lies most powerfully in the hands of private digital platforms. The extent to which that power matters for purposes of the First Amendment and the extent to which that power could lawfully be modified raise interesting and important questions." And he goes on to say, "This petition unfortunately affords us no opportunity to confront them, but he is inviting the American people and the legislative branch, hopefully, to confront them, and we ought to take up that fight."
I agree. And I'll say, I think that speaks to what was so important about this piece of writing is that it's how he framed it. And of course, zooming in on this particular example of Donald Trump's Twitter account is actually really instructive. And the analogy that Thomas uses, if you read the opinion, which is fascinating, I'm not a lawyer, and I still sort of found it fascinating because it is really, really clear-headed and insightful. And he uses this analogy of if the government rents out a room in a hotel, versus if a government employee is at a bar of a hotel, you know, when they have the authority legally and constitutionally to remove somebody from their event, you know, if they control it in the hotel room, one thing. If they're at a bar and the hotel controls it, that's another thing. And so I think part of what was so important is that you have an authoritative conservative legal mind of Justice Thomas's stature exploring, and I don't even think conclusively, but suggesting like the framework here is the common carrier framework. And what I also love about his opinion or this piece of writing from him is that he talks about how we actually don't really have the right modern framework to think about these because these are new technologies. And so trying to apply old regulations and old ways of thinking to something like Twitter, which is really a brand new, is it a public square? No, it's literally not a public square, but does it function as a public square? Yes. So disentangling the different sort of like competing legal interests and competing interests in general is important. And we actually just, it's okay to say, lack the legal framework to do that. And what Justice Thomas was saying is here is the legal framework that best fits the question at hand. We've dealt with this before when it comes to railroads, when it came to telegraphs, So like we've dealt with this in different ways and we have the foundation to do it, but we need to start admitting that, for instance, when we're talking about 230, it's a very different situation. Like Twitter is not USA Today, but it does act in some key ways like USA Today. So how do we come up with the right way to think about this technology and to have somebody of Justice Thomas's stature do that so articulately, I do think was really important. And that's a great way to transition into the second block of what we wanted to talk about today, which is what comes next. And I know you guys probably have a lot of really good thoughts on this. My thought right away, first of all, is that we in general tend to lose sight of how quickly things have changed in our culture and just in our interpersonal relationships. So for people our age, these platforms have become, particularly this was accelerated by the pandemic, our primary mode of interpersonal communication. They are ingrained in our lifestyles inextricably, unless you go full Unabomber, as I sometimes like to joke, but maybe that's not funny. but these are really inextricably entangled into our lifestyles. These platforms have dramatically changed the way that we function because we have, and if you're watching this, you know, Apple Watches on our wrist that trigger dopamine reactions. We have all of these things that have actually, it goes so far beyond the single issue of bias. It goes so far beyond the issue of monopolies, which of course is, you know, bias is downstream of their monopolies. This is about dramatic changes to human life that have happened over, you know, the past decade and just a remarkably short period of time. We can think about how quickly the world changed from 1900 to 2000, but think about how quickly the world changed from about 2008 to 2021, where we are right now. Things are changing really quickly. And that's what, from my perspective, is important to carry from Justice Thomas's piece of writing. And Justice Thomas's opinion here is that, like, this is a totally different, uncharted territory, and we have to start treating it that way. And so the question I'll throw to the group, it gets to a question that Josh asked earlier. How do the tech apologists change going forward? Do they? My opinion is they probably don't, but is there a place that tech apologists who should agree with common good capitalists on the fundamental issue of how markets create efficient products and innovative products and all of those things, how do we kind of marry those you know, very hardened and calcified sides in a way that works? And I will toss that question to the group.
Yes, I mean, I'm happy to hop in first there. Rachel's kind of the tip of the spear for a lot of this, so I look forward to her thoughts, but I'll kind of just give that a first down. I mean, look, as far as a prediction is concerned, I tend to agree with you, Emily. I mean, I'm skeptical that a lot of folks will kind of agree here. I think, as Rachel kind of indicated, we're already seeing a lot of kind of early reaction of kind of besmirching of Clarence Thomas from people who are his allies, frankly, on probably 90%+ or at least 80% of legal issues. But look, as Justice Thomas says in his concurrence, the situation that we currently face is unprecedented. And this is a point that so many of us have been kind of hammering home for a while now, in that we the people have, to an extent willfully, to an extent they've kind of taken a good faith measure at the time, 230, which we'll get into, and kind of run with it. They've turned like a wormhole into a mountain. But we the people, to an extent, have kind of willfully delegated the policing of our proverbial town square to unaccountable private corporate oligarchs. it's very difficult to kind of look at what has happened and conclude anything to the contrary, I think. So to that extent, we are in kind of unprecedented terrain. I think a lot of us are trying to conceptualize and think how to apply like our US Constitution, for example, which as a basic charter of governance only speaks to public state action with the limited exception of the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery both by the government and private servitude. So there's been a lot of kind of clever thinking, but Phil Hamburger, professor of administrative law, has basically said 230 has probably not been interpreted correctly. They can't actually do this. But all this is kind of leading up to this point. And now that Justice Thomas has written this opinion, we need to kind of take it forward from there. The one thing that I want to emphasize here, though, and Justice Thomas does a really good job of this, you know, as somewhat of a common law enthusiast myself, I appreciate this very much. He emphasizes that common carrier is not like this regulatory framework is not kind of a newfangled tool that emerged over the past 20, 30 years. It's not like this was kind of created to deal with regulating AT&T and Verizon or anything like that nature, right? On the contrary, the notion of a common carrier goes back to the English common law. It goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. So to that extent, like we do have kind of ample precedent. The difference, and Thomas says this as well, the difference that the common carrier framework traditionally has been understood to apply to places with a physical location, right? Physical railroads with physical tracks. So it's going to take a different kind of frame of mind to try to reapply these principles to cloud services, right? They don't have like a physical place. But I do think the legal tools are there. We just have to do it by both the federal and the state level. And that's going to be a slow process again. Obviously, American politics is kind of going through a bit of a realignment. I perhaps on shows like this, maybe we tend to emphasize how much that realignment is happening. I still think the median Republican legislator is still going to look at something like common carrier and probably kind of wince or grimace, right? Those of us on the show probably are maybe a little ahead of the curve, so to speak. If I can say that. So it's going to be a slow process. But again, when Justice Thomas is saying this, it is nothing if not a huge paradigm shift.
Yeah, one of the things I've really noticed about working in this space for the last couple of years is something that sort of Josh just alluded to, which is, you know, how far and how fast this debate has moved. And I think, you know, it's driven even, you know, conservatives like me who I think are skeptical, generally speaking, of government action, of things that smack of government regulation, and generally say, you know, that's never going to produce the best outcome. You know, I went from saying, you know, we shouldn't repeal Section 230, you know, to saying maybe we should consider it, right? Maybe we actually should. We've gone from, you know, maybe, you know, regulation is not good to maybe we should consider a common carrier. And, you know, I think that speaks to, again, sort of emphasis behind, you know, what Justice Thomas wrote, which is seeing the world as it actually is, right? Because you can no longer deny, I think, the impact that these companies are having on, again, our democratic society, you know, as it's constituted and as we act as free actors within it. And that's something that I think, you know, 3 or 4 years ago was a completely different conversation than now. And it's because of the actions that big tech has taken. And so there's a lot of people who say, well, you know, you're a hypocrite because you didn't say this back then, or you said this and now you're changing your mind. And it's like, no, I'm trying to respond. I'm trying to keep up with how fast these companies are changing, you know, the way in which we interact with each other. And I think you see that a little bit reflected in the Thomas concurrence. And, you know, when people who are defending these companies, they're making their arguments increasingly irrelevant by failing to recognize this, right? Again, it's this extreme sort of narrowed straw man version of the argument. It's arguing, well, again, because Bing exists, Google can't be a monopoly. You know, it's arguments that just completely don't meet the moment. And, you know, Justice Thomas, I think, had to sort of hat tipped another aspect of this debate, which should, I think, speaks to how the compelling need, I think, for our legislators to step in here, because it's this outsourcing of censorship. You know, more and more we're seeing the government weigh in and sort of push these companies to act in undemocratic ways, which in any other avenue, if the government were to do it, it would be completely unconstitutional. But if you can pressure a company of this scale to do it, the effect is completely the same. It's censorship, regardless of whether it's a private actor doing it, because of the scale of these companies. And that's, again, you see people say, well, it's not censorship because literally the government's not doing it. It's like, guys, wake up to what's actually happening. And so that's where I think we're actually moving. So I do think, as far as a policy perspective, where we go from here, I think antitrust is critical here. Although, you know, I do worry that our antitrust laws are the way they are currently interpreted. You know, I think there is a risk, you know, that because of this extreme narrow focus on price, in markets that aren't driven by price, right? In markets that are driven by innovation, I hope, you know, that our current interpretation is enough to deal with what I think is a very significant threat. But I do think policy changes are warranted as well. You know, Section 230, which I think Ben's going to talk about next, has been sort of grossly judicially contorted away from its original intent of publisher, you know, immunity. And in the process, it's created the most privileged First Amendment actors our society knows or has ever seen. And so what we really need here is legislators with guts that will stand up and actually act, you know, to protect the parameters, you know, of these key elements of our free society. But, you know, so many of these debates fall into partisanship and suppressing speech as opposed to, you know, letting it flourish, that it's a difficult debate in that regard. But I think that probably makes a good transition to Ben on Section 230, because that's sort of central, I think, to the policy debate here.
Yeah, and before I jump into that, let me just say, I think it's worth emphasizing the point you just made, Rachel, about it, that in some ways, it's more insidious when you have censorship by proxy under the guise of a private corporation with government pressure, implicit or explicit, not to mention all the other myriad ties, of course, between the big tech world and Washington, D.C., in terms of funding and personnel and beyond. It's an insidious relationship, and it's insidious when our right to free speech is abridged by government by proxy, which I do think is what we're seeing. And also, to sort of extend Josh's argument, this is almost like the administrative state being an adjunct of the administrative state in the form of private industry, an army of effective government bureaucrats, but who operate under the guise of being a private enterprise, while of course they get the advantages conferred on them, like we're about to talk about, of Section 230. And while they get those privileges, do not also have the responsibility to ensure things like non-discrimination. And that gets to Justice Thomas's point. So let me frame first something I think worth stating, which is what Section 230 says in its findings. And in Section A, subsection 3, it reads in part, "The internet and other interactive computer services offer a forum for a true diversity of political discourse, unique opportunities for cultural development, and myriad avenues for intellectual activity." Okay, does anyone today think that that is how big tech operates? Does it ensure true diversity of political discourse, cultural development, myriad avenues for intellectual activity? I'd say if anything, it's encouraged the antithesis of the purpose, the letter and spirit of Section 230 itself. Of course, the big section that relates to this whole conversation we're talking about today is civil liability. And that section reads in part, "No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be held liable on account of A, any action voluntarily taken in good faith to restrict access to or availability of material that the provider or user considers to be obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected." I think in good faith is imperative to underline there. Does anyone think that big tech operates in good faith when it makes selective decisions as to what content is allowed to be proliferated and what isn't? And also, in the case of a Twitter or Facebook, what trends and what doesn't trend? So I'm just pointing out what Section 230 says versus the actual facts on the ground, what we actually see with our own eyes and have witnessed, and what has caused so many of us to not evolve on the issue, but to look at the reality and operate in reality. Now, Justice Thomas, before this opinion, in a prior opinion in October 2020, not even an opinion, but sort of a writing on a case, wrote in part, "I write to explain why, in an appropriate case, we should consider whether the text of Section 230 aligns with the current state of immunity enjoyed by internet platforms." And in that statement, he writes that the statute suggests that if a company unknowingly leaves up illegal third-party content, it's protected from publisher liability by Section 230. And if it takes down certain third-party content in good faith, it is protected by Section 230 liability. This modest understanding is a far cry from what has prevailed in court. So already he was sort of laying the groundwork for saying, look, the text versus how it's been applied, there's a massive chasm there, and it is ripe for abuse, including of our free speech rights. In this opinion yesterday, he said courts have been, or actually in that prior opinion, he said courts have been filtering their decisions through the policy argument that Section 230 should be construed broadly. And what Justice Thomas raises is that he's skeptical of that view. He says Congress, and I quote, has given digital platforms immunity from certain types of suits with respect to content they distribute, but it has not imposed corresponding responsibilities like non-discrimination that would matter here. And that gets to the arguments about common carriers and how they should have a free and open platform. And then also even public accommodation as a potential other legal avenue by which these platforms ought to ensure non-discrimination. Specifically with respect to Section 230, he references that prior case. And he says some courts have misconstrued to give digital platforms immunity for bad faith removal, referring back to the immunity clause itself. And then he also says some commentators have suggested, as we've talked about on this program before, and as we just talked about, that essentially government is abridging free speech potentially by proxy. And he references this article by Eugene Volokh, which I recommend everyone read and dig into. And he says, according to that argument, when a state creates a private right and a federal statute preempts that state law, quote, the federal statute is the source of the power and authority by which any private rights are lost or sacrificed. And we can dive into the legal minutiae of this, but essentially what Volokh presents is, let's say you have a state that puts forth provisions protecting your political views from discrimination by these big tech platforms. If those platforms challenge you, your right to free speech, and you litigate against them, essentially you have this issue of the federal law preempting whatever the state law said about your free speech rights. And what Thomas is saying is this raises major First Amendment concerns, and it could be that Section 230 itself could potentially fall, or at least the interpretation could be narrowed based upon the fact that your free speech might be being abridged by proxy, again, by private companies under the guise of Section 230. So I'm trying to explain this and distill it as best I can, but really what this all comes down to is simply the letter and spirit of Section 230 versus how it's been applied has been called into question, as have a couple of these different legal avenues that we might take, including viewing these companies as common carriers, including the public accommodation argument. And then of course, including this argument on censorship, abridgment of free speech by the government through a cutout essentially of an organization. And I think those are all compelling arguments. And the Section 230 argument, to me, when we talk about what is sort of the political takeaway from this, it ought to be that this is a litmus test issue. This ought to be a litmus test issue for every not just Republican, but Democrat as well. Do you stand with the people and right to free speech, or do you stand with illiberal big corporations acting at the behest effectively of government to quash and quell competing dissenting opinions? So it ought to be a litmus test issue, and we ought to use all of the above. Justice Thomas has presented some avenues. We ought to use all of the above sort of approach to combating this abridgment of free speech. So that's my sort of monologue on this. And I'd be happy to open it up to anyone about whether, you know, what they make of the merits of Justice Thomas's argument regarding the flaws of Section 230 and how it's been interpreted, or the political ramifications as well.
Yeah, so I'll hop in with 3 points. One is actually before getting into 230, I actually want to just hammer home a point that Ben made at the end of our last segment, which I think is actually really important for the listeners and viewers to grasp here, because it just makes so much sense to me. Analogizing what the tech companies are doing to the administrative state, I think, is an intuitive analogy that Republican legislators, conservative commentators, et cetera, ought to be making far more often. In January, I wrote a blog post called, Reclaim Democracy from Technocracy. And the same way, from that perspective, that Congress ought to kind of recover its Article 1 legislative prerogative from its delegated rulemaking to the administrative state, we the people need to reclaim our sense of governing our own public for our own public square, et cetera, from these unaccountable big tech oligarchs that have taken this 230 immunity 25 years ago and just run with it. Something that obviously is a bastardized form that none of the legislators could have ever envisioned. So just kind of a conceptual perspective, I think that's a really important point to make. I would encourage other commentators, viewers, et cetera, to kind of just ponder it and make it in their own capacities. Two other points, both dealing with 230 itself. So Justice Thomas, I think it was last fall, I can't remember, it was last November or December that he wrote this first 230 writing. In January, I think I mentioned in the last segment, there was Professor Phil Hamburger who wrote this great essay at the Wall Street Journal, How the Constitution Can Save Section 230. Basically making a lot of the same kind of statutory textual arguments here. Ben referenced the good faith provision. I think it's subsection B of the statute. Tech commentators, lawyers refer to that as the so-called Good Samaritan provision of the Section 230 legislation. There was effectively no world, right, in which we can actually read that and conclude that the companies actually have full-on discretion to nuke any material in any account whatsoever. That is not anywhere close to what the actual text of the statute says. But furthermore, and this is kind of the final point I want to make here, not only is it so far removed from kind of the plain text of the statute, but to make a slightly kind of off the beaten path point here, it is dramatically far removed from the intentions of what they possibly intended to do with Section 230. And we know this because, as Ben also said, Congress said expressly in its findings, the point that Rachel has made, including in her USA Today op-ed from December, I think it was, that Congress did this provision of, it was effectively a quid pro quo. The quid was you host a true diversity of opinions. The quo is we're going to immunize you for your good faith conduct, okay? The point here, the operative point, is that when commentators, lawyers, et cetera, are kind of looking at congressional findings, and it's right there, it's in the statute, it's in the preambulatory language of the statute, Congress lists its findings. That exercise, the kind of legal nerd in me looks at that and says, This is what Sir William Blackstone, the great common lawyer, referred to as ratio legis, the reason of the law. This is the reason for the law's existence. This is kind of an antiquated concept that I think a lot of generations of conservative lawyers have just completely forsaken. And we've gotten to this kind of narrow, very kind of a Neil Gorsuch and Bostock style kind of literal textual interpretation. But part of what I'm trying to do with my whole common good originalism thing is trying to recover what Blackstone would refer to as ratio legis. And I've actually in the past, and in my upcoming paper on that topic, what I do is I actually point to the 230 debate to help buttress my argument. It's actually really helpful to try and use 230 as an example to basically say the reason of the law does not support this. Therefore, we should be doing this in a constitutional jurisprudential context as well. So anyway, all these trends of thought kind of collide with one another, but it's very difficult for me to kind of get back to Ben's main points to disagree with Justice Thomas. It seems to me like the Good Samaritan provision of 230 is pretty clearly being misapplied and misinterpreted.
Yeah, I think you guys have done a good job of sort of unpacking, you know, the nature of the statute itself and like what it can do, what it's currently doing and what it really should be doing. But I wanted to make one comment too about the sort of field of and nature of the debate around Section 230, because one of the things that's really hamstrung this debate is this, you know, so many people treat it as if it's so complicated. It's so difficult to understand and you are too dumb to really understand what's happening here. And, you know, they've wrapped it in this sort of condescending language. And I mean, the sort of free speech advocates of 230, that if you remove 230 or you do anything to it, you're gonna burn down the internet. You know, they've called it the 26 words that invented the internet. Like it's become a very sort of high-minded arrogance, the way we talk about what 230, how it was conceived and what it's supposed to do. It's actually not difficult to understand. And especially if you look at sort of the judicial history of the statute, it is easy to see how it has been blown far and away off of its bearings, of when it was originally passed. The legislative debate that took place during that time said nothing about inventing the internet. It said nothing about, you know, this high-minded shield that's going to give these, you know, internet actors the most protection of any company has ever had in the history of America. No, it was basically like, we want to protect kids from porn on the internet. That was effectively the purpose. And it has strayed so far beyond that, that, you know, I would encourage people, you know, who think, oh, this is too difficult for me to understand. It's too tech, you know, it's too wonky. No, ignore all of that commentary. This is a very simple, reasonable thing to understand. And what people are trying to do with it should also be simple and reasonable, because again, it is really just to incentivize these companies to get porn off the internet, to get the smutty stuff off and let us all speak freely. It has become an impenetrable shield when it was conceived as a porous one. And that, I think, is what a lot of the reforms are focused on doing. So I would just add that at the end.
Yeah. And, you know, so people I trust and respect come down on both sides of the 230 question. But to Rachel's point, and to a point that everybody has made, actually, and this is sort of how everything flows naturally in the segments that we do it, it just kind of ends up that way every week. It's so clear that 230 is antiquated, which is kind of a ridiculous word to use for something that's not, you know, relative to the scope of human history or American history, all that old. But it is so clear clearly antiquated. We have so clearly moved beyond the scope that 230 was intended to govern. And it's not the, it's clearly no longer a useful, it's clearly no longer a useful guidance for what it intended to do. And so in that respect, it's obvious that it's just sort of one of those things that it's like clearly time to move beyond 230. You know, that's something that I feel like it should be easy for everybody to agree on. What that actually looks like, okay, there's debate about that, but it's so obvious that we have throttled past what 230 was intended to do. And again, that speaks to, I love the point Rachel made about how quickly things have changed beyond, like, even, you know, people, Rachel herself having different opinions about 230 in the span of just a few years. It's because the companies are changing quickly, the technologies are changing quickly. And what that means is we actually now have to come up with a way for politicians. Our government is not meant to regulate quickly. That's intentional. Right. That's a feature of our republic, right? Like, we're not supposed to be able to adapt really quickly. We do, however, now live in a world where situations change at a rapid rate beyond what anyone could have ever imagined or conceived of when we were founded. That doesn't mean we need to get rid of the filibuster. What it means, however, is that we need to figure out a way for our regulatory framework and for our politicians to be more responsive to rapid changes in society that are induced by technology. So that's kind of a broader 30,000 foot, you know, perspective from somebody who's not a lawyer or like in the weeds on the policy of this. But with that, I think, you know, it's a great segue. We say that constantly to our final section of this conversation, which I will let Josh lead right now.
So, you know, we talk in this podcast a lot, and I think one of kind of the overarching ideals of national conservatism, to use the term of the Edmund Burke Foundation, is kind of a greater emphasis on prudence and pragmatism, kind of an eschewing of kind of blind dogma and ideology. And that is only increasingly important in times and places where things are changing so rapidly, like Emily was just saying. At a time like this, when everything is constantly in flux, I think it makes less sense to be kind of wedded to dogma as opposed to kind of constantly reassessing and trying to come up with prudential, pragmatic, effective solutions. So the same way that, you know, kind of blind nostalgia for the great kind of capitalist frontier of Silicon Valley maybe has kind of lost its allure over time, the allure that, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, Fortune 500 wing of the Republican Party and the conservative movement has at this point, I think, pretty clearly lost much, if not all, of its allure. And, you know, we talk about woke capital a lot on this show, but woke capital has yet again reared its ugly head, I would say in perhaps particularly egregious form, although it seems like just last episode we were talking about Kristi Noem. So it seems like every week we have kind of woke capital bullying conservatives and conservatives capitulating. But slightly different set of facts this week. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about the election law in Georgia. I don't want to get into the policy weeds and talking about X, Y, Z. There have been a million people who have written about this quite persuasively. I will just put it to you this way. Even the Dispatch, you know, the new kind of Steve Hayes, Jonah Goldberg publication has admitted that the leftist hysteria with respect to the Georgia election law is, quote unquote, disingenuous. So when even they're saying that, I think you know that's true. So long story short, you know, major Georgia corporations like Delta Airlines were involved in kind of the careful crafting of this law. It expands early voting days. It is not anywhere remotely close to the Jim Crow 2.0 hysteria that the left is shrieking out about. From my personal perspective, I think a lot of this hysteria is being willfully and purposely drummed up as a way to kind of get the media on board with the nuking of the filibuster and the passing of HR 1. That's just my own reading of the situation. But in any event, this hysteria worked, and we saw Major League Baseball. You know, I know Ben and I at least are baseball fans. I can't speak for Emily, Rachel and Emily. And they took their All-Star game out of Atlanta, and they moved it as of, I think, last night or today to Denver, Colorado, which, you know, I live in Denver, so I guess that's okay. But what's actually going on here is terrible. We see iconic American institutions, and Major League Baseball, baseball is America's pastime, okay? I mean, I'm not going to go full dork mode here, but I grew up going to baseball games all the freaking time. My childhood bedroom was stacked with old school baseball scorecards. I used to stay up and watch the All-Star game as a kid every single year. So it's hard not to take this kind of personally, where like Major League Baseball, like an iconic institution, is just totally caving in on an outright lie. And that is what this is. It is an outright lie that the Georgia election law is 2.0. Obviously, we've seen kind of similar things happening across the country. Texas has a similar kind of election reform, I guess you might want to call it. By the way, just to kind of make this drill this point home, a lot of these so-called election reforms are really doing very little other than to return to the status quo ante after the idiosyncratic 2020 election, which obviously saw kind of proliferating mail-in balloting, absentee balloting, all sorts of things that were that we were told was kind of just a one-off time dispensation from the norm to accommodate for a once-a-century pandemic. But, you know, as Rahm Emanuel famously said, never let a good crisis go to waste, right? So the left has basically taken 2020, now it's the new normal, and trying to go back to the status quo ante makes you Jim Crow 2.0. But in Texas, American Airlines, based there at DFW Airport, very close to where I used to live, similarly has kind of joined Delta Airlines and kind of coming out against this. So we're really seeing kind of woke capital just really kind of trying to consolidate and try to bully and browbeat Republicans like none other. Lots of ideas for where to go from here. I won't filibuster too long because we're kind of running out of time here and want everyone's thoughts. One thing that I think is interesting, our friend Matt Peterson, the Claremont Institute, has tweeted about a so-called red state alliance. It seems to me that some form of collective action is needed here. Some red states, red state governors, someone has to kind of band together, because we can't be having these kind of one-off fights, right? Where Governor Kemp, Governor Abbott, whoever is trying to be like the martyr at the Alamo to try and stand up. There has to be some sort of basic collective action here. Another idea is to actually go full punitive measure, right? You know, our friend John Schweppe at the American Principles Project had a pretty high energy, I would call it Substack post, basically saying kind of make the corporations bleed, make them hurt. At a bare minimum, take away the corporate welfare, right? Take away kind of the incentives that Georgia gives to Hollywood to go shoot their movies there, things like that. But you can actually go further than that too, right? If you want to truly go kind of reward our friends and punish our enemies. I'm not necessarily saying that that is a great idea all the time. Surely there's some sort of prudential way to apply that. But I'll stop filibustering. I'll kind of open up to the panel at this point. Any thoughts from my co-panelists about where we go from here vis-a-vis woke capital?
There's a lot to say. I mean, first of all, in the same way that you guys feel vindicated with Clarence Thomas on 230, I feel completely vindicated on all of these like questions of woke capital, particularly Hollywood and Georgia. I think it's the perfect example. I mean, those subsidies are a freaking racket, and they always have been. And it's just sort of a great example of how Republicans never used to see common good. I mean, basically, like they never used to see these like incentives and subsidies through the lens of the common good when you're giving all of the throwing all of this money at Hollywood, Hollywood, which is an enemy of everything that conservatism really should stand for beyond the sort of like fiscal conversation. Yeah, they make a lot of money, but they also do it at a great cost to our culture. So, I mean, it's just, that's always been a perfect example. And, you know, I'm glad that it's sort of coming into focus, but at the same time, I don't know that Republicans in Georgia really have the backbone to follow through on it. It's funny because guess who else opposes the boycotts of Georgia? Stacey Abrams, all of the Georgia Democrats. Of course they do, because there's so much money that's brought in from Hollywood. And what happens with that is they bring in a lot of temporary workers. They bring in a lot of people from LA. It doesn't necessarily clearly benefit Georgia in the way a lot of politicians say that it does. And so this is sort of my long-winded way of saying I feel vindicated as well on the subsidies as a perfect instructive example of where conservatives have lost focus of common good, what that actually means. And we need to ask the question, why do these corporations behave this way? Why is there the pressure on Delta? Why is there the pressure on the MLB? Where is that pressure coming from? That pressure is coming from other corporations, media corporations. And those media corporations are being run by millennial college graduates who have had their worldview filtered through our system of higher education that teaches people you are necessarily either a progressive and you agree fully on all of the dogma, or you are a bigot. And that is the driving force behind every single one of these decisions, because the corporations, the boomers that run the corporations, are afraid to cede are afraid to overrule the millennials because that means they're a bigot. So the cost-benefit analysis almost always seems to go into the direction of appeasing them, but that snowballs. And then on the other hand, millennials are now running these companies. And so you have the threat of public relations from woke media, and that's where you get woke corporations. And that's basically the formula, or the recipe that gives us woke capitalism. And it's wildly out of step with the rest of the country. I mean, just completely out of step with the rest of the country. So I think what Josh is calling for is kind of a cultural version of Grover Norquist. You know, what can we come up with that functions in such a way? And the point is that in the same way Republicans used to kind of revere taxes, tax cuts and lower taxes and all of that, we need to realize that what we should be revering above all else is a healthy culture that is good for our kids, that is good for families. And we need to start disentangling capitalism, or the capitalism that we've allowed to sort of grow full of weeds. We need to start thinking about our priorities as a conservative movement, as the right, and honestly, as a country, because there's a swath of the left that also agrees with this. And that, I mean, if you listen to like Red Scare, which is obscene, but also a great example of the realignment, they're coming from the sort of Bernie left, and they, you know, talk all of the time about pro-family and about the sort of nature, the essential nature of biology for men and for women and what that means in a practical everyday lifestyle. And so there's just, you know, there's a lot to talk about, but I'll give up my ground right now to someone else who has thoughts.
Well, yeah, let me just follow up on a couple points you made there. I would argue that today we are more corporatist than capitalist, if not fascistic, in the textbook definition of it, in the sense of private industry and government working hand in hand, which is pretty much the overarching sort of meta narrative of this entire episode. And our economic system is downstream of our culture, just like our politics is down from our culture. So for those people who claim to care about free enterprise and actual capitalism, well, it starts with a culture of liberty, and then you have an economy that is a liberal economy. And we are so far unmoored from that. We ought to speak openly and honestly about where we are as a nation today. To the point about MLB, and yeah, to Josh's point, this sickens me, it enrages me. I've spent 25 years spending about 3 hours a night over 100 days a year on having the unfortunate fandom of being a Mets fan, traveled across the country following the team, spent a small fortune on tickets and travel and food and beverage and the like. And it's just a total smack in the face to me and probably the more than half the country or of baseball fans, the more than half of baseball fans who are like-minded ideologically. So it's sickening on one level, but on another level, it speaks to the deeper problem that we face, which is that leftism doesn't only corrupt everything it touches, but it has to insinuate itself in every single aspect of our society. Nothing is safe from it. Not our companies, not our sports, not anything. And everyone seems to cave, even though it's a small fringe on the left that is pushing these narratives and propagating them, in part because, of course, yes, our mainly leftist elites do control the commanding heights of society, and we don't, but also because there's never an equal and opposite reaction from our side. The other side is organized, and even though it's a small fringe that holds this ideology deeply, it propagates it, it pressures, and it cajoles and uses every lever of power that it can possibly have. So until there's an equal and opposite reaction, and we've harped on this before, we're gonna lose every single time. The anti-cultural revolution is gonna continue to burn through society absent an understanding of the stakes, which goes back to Josh's point, the sort of Burkean point about, I would argue essentially, this is wartime ideologically. And so the normal rules of ideological engagement of combat do not apply. We're talking about survival of our most basic fundamental principles. And so that requires different means than we might otherwise apply if we were just having a good faith argument and we all shared at core the same principles and beliefs and views as to what our regime in a classical sense ought to look like, but that's not where we are today. So consequently, if one side wants to dominate and do everything it can to impose its will upon you, and you say, well, we need to let all views proliferate and may the best one win, of course, you know what side is going to win in that debate. And ultimately, then we lose the country and we're well on our way to doing so, absent there being a serious counter-revolutionary force. And I don't mean a revolution here, but I mean in the sense of look, the other side has to face the same consequences that we face on a daily basis. And we're nowhere near that, but hopefully this show and others will provide some ideas for how we go about doing that. So I just think it's important to make those points. And then just a narrower point, I first of all, not just the Dispatch, but even the Washington Post gave 4 Pinocchios to Joe Biden and sort of his view of the Georgia laws. So when you've lost the Washington Post, you know you've lost. But I do think this is part of a broader information operation in effect to make everything Jim Crow, so that essentially the left and maybe some in the Republican establishment too, I pray not, but so that the left can impose their voting rights agenda on the country, obliterate the filibuster, and on, which goes to the point of doing anything and everything it takes to ultimately win, to achieve total power. That's what we're up against. And I think we all understand the stakes. And increasingly, everyone with their own eyes is seeing that those are the stakes. The leadership in the Republican Party does not seem to be there. And maybe that speaks to the fact that, or it speaks to an imperative that there ought to be new leadership ultimately.
So I'll just weigh in and I'll make this my sort of final around the room thought for the episode. But I do think so much of this speaks to how the Republican Party, you know, when we talk about the realignment and all these things, how it must change if it is going to survive. And by that, I mean, its motivating force is to protect individual liberty and to create a country where diverse views, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of thought all flourish. To ensure that that continues to happen, the Republican Party and conservatives generally are going to have to drop this orthodoxy that Ben, I think, aptly labeled corporatism, which is that you kneel at the feet of big business and you say, all good, full stop, nothing more to see. Because we are now seeing, again, this collusion between this sort of woke corporatism and woke big government to enforce a specific set of beliefs on this entire country. So we have to change our approach. And you know, I think, you know, Josh talks frequently about, you know, using power to reward our friends and punish our enemies. I would say even at a bare minimum beyond that, it's just stop rewarding with policy the companies that hate us. Like, we have privileged these companies so far above, you know, any other type of business. It was interesting when, you know, the Georgia law, you know, or when MLB announced it was gonna remove itself from Georgia, you know, conservatives were, I think the Georgia House responded by stripping, or am I thinking it was MLB or was it Delta? It was one of the two companies. So much again has happened so quickly. Georgia House responded by stripping one of these companies of their special tax subsidy. And the Washington Post, Greg Sargent, I thought was completely inappropriate, tweeted out, oh, look, conservatives are squealing for cancel culture now. And it's like, okay, bro, no, that's not cancel culture. But two, like, it's literally a baseline of saying, oh, I'm sorry, company, you now have to compete in the free market like the rest of everyone, you know, everybody else. It's, you don't get your specially tailored government subsidy, right? That is not a punishment, okay? That is now you're being tossed into the sea to have to compete like everybody else. And so at a bare minimum, I think that's what we should expect. You know, Republicans for years have taken it on the chin from these companies and then, you know, supported them, helped, you know, clapped loudly as they line up at the trough and expect, you know, deregulatory efforts that expect tax cuts. Again, all specially tailored just for them, and we've always given it to them. So I think, a threshold test for Republicans going forward, our policymakers and our politicians, is, you know, to see how this has diminished us, to see the direct effect of giving these companies so much market power that they can turn around and enforce their woke views on you to no consequence. That has to change. And I think, you know, broadly speaking, that is the first step. If the Republicans are going to actually have a realignment here, that has to be step one. So I'll just leave that as my final thought.
So that was Rachel's final thought. So let's just go around the room and kick it over to somebody else who wants to offer their final thoughts for this episode of NatCon Squad.
Yeah, I'll be exceedingly quick here because we're running a little late. I emphatically endorse literally everything Rachel just said, which is perhaps unsurprising. But I also want to highlight something that that Ben just said as well here. Look, we're not, you know, we're not Marxists here. We don't agree that all means are necessary to achieve our utopian ends. Saul Alinsky, of course, basically stood for the proposition that any means are necessary to achieve one's ends. That is not our stance. Okay, surely there is some distinction between means and ends. Having said that, when we are facing what we're currently facing, and it's a theme that we talk about on the podcast every week here, I think you have to prudentially and pragmatically look at the situation and at a bare minimum recognize that a broader Overton window of means than what we are necessarily comfortable talking and thinking about have to be on the table to secure our ends, to secure the ends of the American regime and the American way of life. So that's kind of the theme of this podcast, I think, and I'll kind of just leave it on that.
Yeah, what about you, Ben?
Yeah, I would also endorse Rachel's remarks wholeheartedly. And I think the simplistic way to say it is there should be a do no harm principle. And so if the other side is harming you and you're actively aiding and abetting that harm, cease doing so. I think that should be a baseline measure before we talk about sort of offensive means. And since I usually try to close on somewhat more of a positive note than the, you know, we're facing a totalitarian onslaught and we're, you know, they're basically at the 1 yard line and we have no defense, or I don't know what the best baseball analogy is, but we're down 10-0 in the ninth inning. It feels as if the odds are stacked. Look to Justice Clarence Thomas as a model American citizen. I agree with Josh. He's one of the greatest Americans ever in the history of the nation. And he's proven that in being a defender par excellence now of free speech. I've written before about him taking on universal injunctions, which is a narrower issue, but which he's been courageous on as well. Taking on the administrative state, national law jurisprudence, putting forth that philosophy more broadly. And as an individual, his character is really unmatched. And the assault, the onslaught that he's been taking for decades is just vicious. And he continues to stand up and be a remarkable voice on the Supreme Court, who has put forth opinions that are game changing, that will live on for decades, hopefully, and maybe centuries, hopefully too, if we're able to ultimately triumph. So we should all look to Justice Clarence Thomas and try to be one millionth of the person that he is, and follow in his footsteps as a courageous defender of liberty and justice.
Just to bring everything full circle, I think it's important to see all of this as the collision of a hyper secular society and centralized market power. And those things are all sort of undergirded, I think, by the hyper-secularism. It's a lot more dangerous to have Facebook and Twitter in an era that is also hyper-secular. It's more dangerous to have Amazon in an era that is hyper-secular, where you have somebody like Jeff Bezos' net worth increasing exponentially during a pandemic. And, you know, his wealth is going up while a lot of people feel that they are suffering. And that may sound like Occupy Wall Street rhetoric, but it's actually just kind of the reality we face ourselves in. And conservatives probably should have started realizing around 2011, when Occupy Wall Street sprang forth, that we need to have an answer to that sense of, you know, the sense that we're becoming an oligarchy. Even if people don't put it into those words, it has more than sort of like the way that the Tea Party movement was misinterpreted by so many people on the right and on the left, is that this was a fundamentally, you know, this was about limited government and this was about fiscal responsibility, when in fact it was much more cultural. And, you know, I think hyper-secularism is really at the central level of so much of this. And, you know, without that lens and without that framework, we run the risk of misinterpreting writing like Justice Thomas's opinion that was released this week. So with that, on behalf of Ben, Rachel, Josh, thanks for tuning in. I'm Emily Jashinsky. We'll see you at the next NatCon Squad.